Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Realm presents Bookburners, Episode 3.
One. The door was just a wooden door, made from three wide planks. Sal had just walked through the wide rooms and long hallways of the Vatican Library, with their marble and their frescoes and their saints in a million colors. The kind of stuff that hits you over the head with the knowledge that you were most definitely not in America anymore. Old Europe. Old money. Old secrets. Secrets within secrets. Compared to all that, this door looked like it was going to lead to a broom closet. Except there was Father Manchu, his hands behind his back, waiting for her. And there was a seven-pointed star on the door. "Looks a little satanic for around here, doesn't it?" Sal said.
"Everyone says that the first time they see it," Manchu said. "It's an old symbol of protection. The society's entire library is shaped like that star. Ready to see it?"
Sal nodded.
"You sure you're all right?"
Manchu said. "I'm fine," Sal said. "Let's go." Manchu opened the door. They found themselves in a little room with no apparent purpose, bad architecture, which, considering it was the Vatican, was a little surprising. If this were in America, there would be vending machines here, Sal thought to herself. Vending machines and trash cans. But it was just the top of a staircase, a twisting black metal staircase.
"It's wrought iron," Manchu said.
"More like overwrought," Sal said. Manchu laughed. "You haven't even seen all of it yet." The stairs corkscrewed below them for what seemed like at least four stories. The middle column was a rod of iron. The outside was a lattice of metalwork that Sal thought at first was covered in barbs, until she saw that the barbs were animals and trees, figures of people in the act of various gestures. The wonders of the natural world. It was beautiful. It was like being inside a birdcage. The ceiling above them vaulted away from the staircase and down in seven separate vertical segments like frozen waves, like outstretched wings. "We're in the center of the star," Sal thought. There was light below them. Sal looked down. She was looking at a city made of books. Books were stacked into skyscrapers, piled into neighborhoods. They seemed to cover the entire floor, from the walls to the bottom step of the staircase. As she got closer, Sal could see narrow pathways through the towers. Someone had started off with a system, bookcases and neat columns across the room. The bookcases were still there. But the project had gotten out of hand, and now the cases were jammed, and there were stacks of books on top of them. Though off to the left, there was a place that looked like a clearing, a source of light.
"Asante?" Manchu said.
"Yes?" a voice called from the clearing. Sal couldn't say why, but she liked whoever was talking already.
"Is everyone here?"
"Yes," Asante answered. Sal could just about hear her smiling. A different voice, then. Grace's. "You're late. By 8 minutes."
"I'm sorry," Manchu said.
He really means that, Sal thought. What does that mean? "I'll meet you at the bottom of the stairs," Asante said. "I've moved a few things around, so it's not as easy to get through." Asante was tall, a good 3 inches taller than Sal, and her long dreadlocks, piled and twisted into a colorful scarf, made her seem taller still. But there was nothing imposing about her. Only a quick smile, eyes that seemed to spark. "So, you're the new recruit Manchu thinks so highly of." She extended a hand. "I'm Archivist Asante." "Sal." They shook hands.
Welcome to the Black Archives of the Societas Librorum Occultorum. Come in, the others are waiting. Asante guided Sal and Manchu through the towers of books, talking as she went. The library was built in the 1400s. The architecture gives that away, don't you think? When the society's collection grew a little too large and a little too dangerous to have in broad daylight or just sitting in some monastery. Take a left. No, the other left. That's it. We are now in the only central chamber of the library. There are 7 chambers radiating off this one. Each one has a small antechamber with the larger rooms beyond that. Just in case something gets out in the library, you understand? Then we need to seal it in. Sal glanced back at the staircase. Now it looked like a strand of DNA ascending into the gloom until it disappeared in the middle of the ceiling. Let me guess, Sal said. The antechambers are really small, awkward spaces. That's right, Asante said. Like the room at the top of the stairs. Exactly, Asante said. The idea being that at least some of the things that get out of the books, if they get out, are too big to fit in those spaces. Asante looked back at Manchu. I see why you brought her on, she said. How often do they get out? Sel asked. Asante and Manchu looked at each other.
It hasn't happened yet on our watch, Manchu said.
And before that? Sal said. The last one was centuries ago, Asante said. We've learned to take far more precautions now. They came to the clearing Sal had seen from the stairs. There was a wide oriental rug on the stone floor. Liam was sitting on a couch. He gave Sal a quick, friendly smile. Grace was standing by a coffee table, her arms folded. An easy chair next to the coffee table was empty. Lamps balanced on stacks of books, which functioned as end tables. At the far end of the rug was a desk with another wooden chair behind it. On the desk, besides still more books and a phone that looked about 50 years old with a compact switchboard attached to it and a small lamp, was a faintly glowing orb housed in a glass case hooked up to a contraption of wires, gears, and screens. What's that? Sal asked.
Cuts to the chase, doesn't she? Liam said.
Grace nodded with approval.
This, Asante said, is how we get our assignments.
What, do you shake it up? Sal said. Like a magic eight ball?
Unbelievable that I never thought of that before, Liam said.
Grace and Manchu both looked at Liam. What is she talking about? Grace said.
It's this,
Liam mimed shaking an eight ball.
What, like a cantaloupe? Grace said. No, Liam said. You ask it questions, like you're using it to tell fortunes.
You use a cantaloupe to tell people's fortunes?
Manchu said.
No, it's... Can we move on, please?
Grace said. Sal nodded. This woman is speaking my language.
Yes, let's, Asante said. We just call it the orb. It alerts us when a new magical force appears in the world.
I don't follow, Sal said.
It could be that some magical event has occurred. It could be that some sort of creature has, emerged from wherever they emerge from. Or that someone has cast a powerful spell. Or it could be as simple as someone opening a magic book.
Opening a book where? Sal said.
Anywhere, Asante said. Anywhere in the world.
It looks old, Sal said.
This society has had the orb for centuries, Asante said.
But some of those parts look a little newer than that, Sal said.
Over the centuries, as the society's work has broadened and become more precise, we've been able to make some modifications.
You've figured out how magic works? Sal said.
Asante looked at Manchu again.
Not exactly, Asante said.
Sal's brow furrowed. She turned to Manchu.
The society uses magic? She said, accusing, hurt.
It did, Manchu said, in the past. It doesn't anymore, not like that.
Asante sighed. That's not much of an answer, Sal said. Well, it's the best one you're going to get right now, Detective, Grace said. I'm guessing that as a former law enforcement officer, you're smart enough to know that the society's relationship to magic is complicated, even though its stated mission is to lock magic away forever. Yes?
Yes, Sal said.
Great, Grace said. So you're okay?
I'm fine, Sal said. She took a deep breath. Please, just continue.
Grace turned to Asante. You were saying?
All right, Asante said. She pointed to a small display of flip clock numbers. Thanks to the modifications, when the orb detects a magical anomaly, it is able to tell us where it happened. Latitudinal and longitudinal coordinates, right down to the second.
Well, Liam said, that machine's a bit... He waved one hand in the air equivocally.
Dodgy.
It's close, Menchu said.
Yeah, Liam said. Close enough to buy plane tickets. Then it's my job to start really narrowing it down. I check with my network, antiquarians, curio collectors, parish priests, magic hunters.
Magic hunters? Sal said.
Yeah, you know, like tornado hunters, except magic, Liam said.
So those ghost hunter cable TV shows are real?
Oh no, those are fake. If they were real, the cameras wouldn't work around the ghosts.
We're getting off topic, Grace said. Again.
Right, Liam said. I also read the papers. I listen in on police chatter, check blogs even. Status updates, like I do all the time, except in a more focused way. Looking for anything weird.
You're looking all the time? Sal said.
Well, yeah, because it turns out even the orb doesn't catch everything. It catches most things, Menchu said.
Some things, Liam said.
I imagine you find plenty on your own anyway, Sal said and looked at Grace. Grace smiled back at her. Thank you for keeping these boys in line.
Absolutely, Liam said. Even when the orb goes off and I'm narrowing it down, I find a lot of things not related to what we're looking for. But eventually, usually by the time we absolutely need it, I've narrowed it down so we can bag it and tag it.
Bag it? Sal said. Menchu produced a shroud from his pocket.
If it's a book or some other artifact that we can carry, we wrap it in this. Keeps the magic contained until we can bring it back here.
Let me guess, Sal said. That shroud is magic too.
Menchu shrugged helplessly.
The mission couldn't be clearer, he said. Find the magic and lock it up.
Lock it up.
He said it, Sal thought, as if he was passing along a mantra, something he repeated to himself to keep his focus.
So, you collect all these books and magic wands and amulets, bring them here, and then what happens? Sal said.
Then she looked around. These aren't all magic books around us, are they?
Oh, no, that would be dangerous, Asante said. These are just reference books, the real magic books. I catalog and then lock away in one of the 7 chambers connected to this room.
And no one ever looks at them again, Sal said.
Well, Liam said, that's the idea anyway.
Why don't you just destroy them?
Someone tried that about 700 years ago, Liam said. Turns out we don't know how to destroy a magic artifact without unleashing the magic that the artifact contains. Thankfully, they had the good sense to try it on something relatively benign.
Relatively, Menchu said. The artifact turned water into wine.
That doesn't sound so bad, Sal said.
The reports of the aftermath are sketchy, Menchu said. But it seems that there was a flash as the artifact exploded, and it affected all the water within a half mile of here, including the water in the people.
Oh, Sal said.
Yes, Menchu said. It's not a mistake we want to make again.
So, what happens now? Sal said.
No, Menchu said.
He looked at the orb.
We wait.
We have a little downtime, then?
Yes, until we get our assignment.
Then I want to see my brother. Menchu nodded.
Let's go, he said.
Sal was already lost. They were in another part of the Vatican Library, another underground hallway, though this one was as ornate as could be, more ornate, even, than the places in the library above ground where tourists gawked and took pictures. It meant something for a secret part of the building to look like this, Sal figured. Someone, at some point, had amassed a lot of wealth, a lot of power for part of the organization, and with those things, a lot of impunity, and they wanted whoever visited them to know it.
Got it. Sal thought,
loud and clear.
We're not keeping my brother in a hospital, Sal said.
We moved him here because we thought this would be safer, Menchu said.
Not for him, Sal thought. For everyone else.
You may not be on an elite team of investigators fighting the dangers of magic, but that doesn't mean you have to be defenseless when it comes to protecting your data online. Lucky for you, our partners at NordVPN know their way around the World Wide Web. VPN stands for Virtual Private Network, which creates a sort of encrypted tunnel while you're online, protecting your private data like bank details and passwords, so you can browse safely wherever you are in the world. In addition to providing you with a high level of security online, my favorite use of NordVPN is to virtually switch my location, so I can watch movies and shows that aren't currently available in my area. Plus, that way I can still access my favorite content when I'm traveling as well. I'm a fan of pretty much any British TV show, but they aren't always available in the US, so with NordVPN, I can virtually travel across the pond to enjoy my telly. NordVPN is also the fastest VPN in the world, and you can get all that speed, protection, and virtual locations for the price of just a coffee a month. To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/bookburners. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. We can imagine many potential futures. Some serve as inspiration, others, warnings. Wondery offers one possibility of the future in their new show, The Last City. The year is 2072, and the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven. Pura is a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she's willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Ray Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. The days might be feeling longer now that the sun is setting later, but that unfortunately does not mean that I actually have more time in the day. And that's why I love Factor's ready-to-eat meals. They make it so easy to eat stress-free this spring with their fresh, never-frozen, chef-crafted meals that are ready to eat in just 2 minutes in the microwave. And these are no ordinary microwave meals, let me tell you. They have truly delicious options. I just had this loaded bacon, chicken, and spinach meal that was so tasty. And you can even try meals with premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, broccolini. My mouth's just watering thinking about it. Factor eliminates the hassle of prepping, cooking, and cleaning up, so it kind of does feel like you're adding some time back to your day. If you'd like to try it out for yourself, head to factormeals.com/burners50 and use code BURNERS50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code BURNERS50 at factormeals.com/burners50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Manchu gestured to a row of 4 carved wooden doors painted and embossed with gold. They look like stained glass windows.
"These are the offices of the Monsignors for the Society," he said. "One for each team. Team 1 was and is a full combat team. Team 2 became diplomacy and public relations. You could think of Team 3, that's us, as acquisitions and storage."
Sal nodded toward the 4th door. "What does Team 4 do?" Sal said.
"There is no Team 4, Manchu said.
Sal raised an eyebrow. "Please go on." Manchu caught it.
"There used to be a Team 4. He said, just as there used to be a lot more magic in the world. The Society originally developed 4 teams to deal with the magic."
"What was Team 4's job?" Manchu paused, looking for the phrase.
"Research and development," he said at last.
"They try to use magic," Sal said.
"As I said," Manchu said, "there is no Team 4 anymore. The Society, and especially the fighters on Team 1, are very grateful for what Team 4 accomplished.
But there came a time when the risks were not worth the gains.
They passed by a large space that looked like a courtroom. Natural light streamed in from above. The ceiling was several stories above them and all glass.
So that's how far below ground we are right now, Sal thought.
This is where we all meet when we need to,
Manchu said.
The team leaders, the monsignors, and the cardinal.
So the cardinal sits behind the bench?
When he's officiating, yes,
Manchu said. To pass judgment?
Sometimes to appear impartial, Manchu said. Or simply to understand what happened in a complicated case.
But Sal could tell she'd struck a nerve. Manchu didn't like the hierarchy any more than she did. Maybe he liked it less.
What the hell, Sal thought. Let's poke that nerve.
You've been here a while, she said.
Yes, Manchu said.
Ever thought about having the cardinal's job?
I've thought about it, Manchu said.
Didn't want to pursue it?
It was offered to me once. I didn't take it.
Desk job's not for you?
It's complicated, Manchu said.
Two men wearing vestments passed them in the hallway. They both, Sal noticed, had unusually shaped heads. One of them was very round. Sal imagined his skull looking like a volleyball. His face was packed into the center of the front of it. His tiny ears seemed glued to the side, and his hair didn't know what to do. There was no place to lie flat. The other man had a very long face, a towering forehead. It was as though his head was made of taffy. Sometime during his childhood, someone had pulled on it, and it didn't go back to normal. Balloon and stretch, Sal thought. She took a mental picture. Manchu nodded at them. They nodded back. Then, in unison, they gave Sal a very scrutinizing glance, a once-over, sizing her up. Cold, calculating. Sal got the distinct impression that they didn't like what they saw. The two men kept walking. Sal waited until they were out of earshot. Who are they?
Desmet and DeVos, Manchu said. Part of Team 2.
Those guys are part of diplomacy and public relations, Sal said.
Also exorcisms, Manchu said.
Sal almost laughed.
And they're good at their job, Manchu said. That's what matters.
But Sal could still hear a little twinge in his voice. There had been a reason he didn't introduce her to them, and it hadn't just been because she didn't speak Italian.
Come on, Manchu said.
The hallway turned and turned again until they reached another carved door, not as ornate as the others. Unpainted.
Here,
Manchu said. The room had paneled walls, a plaster ceiling with a chandelier, a woven rug on a deep red wooden floor. But other than that, it was a hospital room. Perry lay on a bed with a thick mattress and a metal frame, surrounded by machines. Wires ran from his scalp. An IV ran from one arm. Sal went to his side and put a hand on his chest.
He's breathing on his own, at least, she said, putting the bravest words she could find on what she was seeing.
He looks good. Manchu kept a respectful distance.
He's receiving the best care he could get anywhere, he said. We're looking after him physically and spiritually.
Supernaturally, you mean? Sal said.
Holistically, Manchu said. It was a gentle correction. Your brother isn't in prison or quarantine. If he woke up and he was...
Himself, Sal said.
Yes, himself, Manchu said. He would be free to go. We wouldn't keep him.
Sal swallowed. I know we've talked about this already, she said. I know you can't say what the chances are of getting that demon.
The hand, Manchu said.
Yeah, the hand. I know you can't say what the chances are of getting it out of him or if there's anything else we could be doing to wake him up. I understand that it's all a big question mark, but he's still in there, right? Or has he been taken somewhere?
We think he's still in there, Manchu said.
And he's not brain dead? Sal said.
No, Manchu said. Not physically, no.
She moved her hand from Perry's chest to his forehead. What's it like for him in there? She said. There was a long pause. She could tell Manchu was searching for an answer.
God only knows, he said at last.
God and Perry, she said. Then, just Perry. How do we reach him? He's all by himself in there, Sal thought. Out there, all alone. Then she had another much worse thought. Except that he isn't alone. Not at all. Right then, the chances of finding the cure, finding the right book, seemed so remote, impossible, the tiniest sliver of a needle in a universe of haystacks. They'd found a pair of wings, Menchu had told her, a well that answered questions. Wondrous and useless, totally useless. Where was the book that would bring her brother back? And who in the world was going to find it? 2. Gabriel lived by himself in Madrid, in the apartment where he was raised, a ramshackle string of rooms off a long hallway that smelled vaguely of mildew, though he could never find the source. His parents had both died, his father years ago, his mother not soon after, and he lived among the things they had left behind. The wallpaper was starting to peel off the walls. His parents had put it up when they moved in. That was their double bed in the biggest bedroom, their bedspread. Gabriel ate at the dining room table they had bought when they were first married. The curtains he drew over the windows were the ones his mother had made. Gabriel's only regular visitors were two sisters from upstairs, Elena and Victoria, who came over every few days when they needed to escape their own parents, their own smaller apartment. They thought of Gabriel's place as their secret castle. To them, its rooms were vast and unending, and they spent hours exploring them. The remnants of his parents' lives were souvenirs from distant places. They loved the collection of figurines of angels and animals that Gabriel's mother had kept. They took them out and played with them on the dining room table while Gabriel made them a snack. Gabriel liked the girls, appreciated the company. Gabriel kept the apartment, just barely, through a series of small jobs. He had been an office clerk, then he was a cashier at a pharmacy, then he became the manager of a movie theater. It was his favorite of the jobs he'd had, even though he knew there was no way it was going to last. The theater was falling apart around him. It was in worse shape than his apartment, while the street bustled with pedestrians outside. Almost none of them ever came inside. But he loved the movies. The owner had a taste for the surreal, which suited Gabriel fine. They played The Spirit of the Beehive once a month. They ran Buñuel. They ran Jodorowsky. Gabriel sat in the back, behind the three or four other people in the theater, and let those movies take him away. He knew they were supposed to be unsettling. They were designed to worm their way into your brain and lay eggs, change you. But they didn't unsettle Gabriel. He found them soothing. They were an escape. At last, the theater's owner decided to close down the theater for good and asked Gabriel to help him and some kids he'd hired off the street to clean the place out. The kids were from somewhere in North Africa. Gabriel didn't ask where because it seemed rude. They spoke very little Spanish and worked hard. Gabriel gave them a couple hammers, screwdrivers, and a crowbar and got them on the job of removing all the theater's fixtures, the counter, the lights, the carpeting, all of which the owner was hoping to sell. Gabriel went down to the basement to clear out the film canisters that hadn't been touched in years. He was sure the film inside was ruined. It had to be. As much as the owner loved movies, he hadn't taken care of the stock. So it was just a question of clearing everything out. Which was how Gabriel found the book. It was on an upper shelf in a closet, along with some old canisters and a rusty wrench. Gabriel had no idea how long it had been there. He slid it off the shelf and held it in his hands. It was big enough that he had to cradle it like a baby, a heavy baby. The cover's thick leather was so wrinkled and textured that it looked like a mountain range seen from a plane. Gabriel brought it under the light of the naked bulb above him. There was the faint outline of a title. It had been legible once, maybe even gilded, but the gold was long gone, the lines that formed the letters worn away. As he was running his hand over it, he noticed that the book was warm. He had the strong sense that he had discovered something he shouldn't have, but he wanted it anyway. He left the book in the basement when he dismissed the boys for the day so they wouldn't see it. After everyone had left, he waited until the street was a little quieter. Then he carried the book home that night in his arms. He had left the windows open in his apartment and it was cold. He put the book down on the dining room table. The windows rattled as he closed them. The floorboards creaked beneath his feet. As he moved from room to room, he was more than ever aware of the bleakness of his surroundings. There was the threadbare couch he could remember from his childhood. It was long past used up. There was the braided rug on the floor, worn and faded. There was the chair he'd found on the street and dragged to his apartment. It took him 2 hours to do it, and he almost never sat in it. The dim, tiny kitchen, the bathroom with the chipped tub. All the photographs on the walls were pictures other people had taken. Almost none of them included him. He picked up the book. It still felt warm in his arms, even warmer than before. It occurred to Gabriel that he couldn't remember the last time he'd ever had anybody over, besides Elena and Victoria. He didn't know the girl's parents at all, beyond the barest friendly acquaintance, and he knew no one else in the building. The apartments had all turned over since he was a kid, and he hadn't met any of the newcomers. He couldn't remember the last time he'd been out, either, with other people. He wasn't sure when he'd stopped calling his friends or returning their calls. They must have stopped trying to reach him after a while, but he couldn't pinpoint the precise moment it happened. At the time, he felt like he was making tiny decisions. He'd receive a message, a voicemail, a text, something. Then he'd think to himself, I'd just rather stay in tonight. But now he saw how all those decisions added up. He'd walked out of the crowd step by step over the years and kept walking, and now he was alone. He regretted all of that. If I could be anyone else now, he thought, anywhere else, I'd be happier. His bedroom was at the end of the long hallway. He went in and sat at the desk at the window. He put the book in front of him on the desk and opened it. It was written in a language he didn't recognize, with letters he'd never seen before. Were they even letters? Was it some kind of code? It was impossible to tell. He started leafing through the book, thinking there might be some diagrams or pictures, something to tell him what the book was about. There weren't. It was just page after page of indecipherable characters. Then, under his fingers, the book got even warmer. The ink on the pages wriggled. The lines moved, rearranged themselves into words Gabriel knew, sentences he understood. He was in the middle of a story, a vast one, full of characters and action, too much to comprehend at once, too compelling to ignore. He flipped back to the beginning of the book, the first chapter, and read the first sentence. Gabriel, said a voice close by. His mother was standing right behind him. She put her hand on his shoulder. His father stood on his other side, smiling, hands in his pockets. How are you here? Gabriel said. Just keep reading, his father said. The walls of the room began to glow, as if they were made of paper and there was a warm light behind them. They wavered. A ripple passed through them. The floorboards heaved and settled, heaved and settled. Gabriel could hear more people behind him, friendly voices and laughter. He looked up at his father. His father wasn't his father anymore. He was someone Gabriel didn't recognize, but knew was a friend, a good friend. His mother had changed, too, into someone else, someone Gabriel felt he had known for years. They had traveled the world together. He looked up into the darkened window. It was a mirror now. It was a vertical pool of water, still and unbroken. It carried his reflection, and he could see that he was not himself. He had changed into a younger man, tired after a long trip, but satisfied with what he had done. Now, he was an older woman, flooded with memories of decades spent with her partner, two women living on the edge of a knife. She wouldn't take any of it back. Now he was an artist at the end of his life. He'd made a series of paintings that he already knew would outlast him. 200 years from now, they would fill people with awe. Now he was a girl with all her life in front of her, nothing but possibility. She was surrounded by crowds, family, friends, people who would soon change her life. The water on the wall became a waterfall, and it unfurled into a river that flowed between his feet. The walls gave way and the ceiling opened up. The floor broke apart into a rich soil. Trees shot from the ground, climbed into the night sky, and spread their limbs above Gabriel's head until they covered the stars. Gabriel looked down at the book on the desk, the open page. The ink was moving faster and faster, words flashing by, sentences shooting across the page like arrows. He knew it was all going more quickly than he could read, but somehow he understood it all. He was ecstatic, breathless, so carried away that he didn't notice at first that his fingers had sunk into the book itself. His hands had melted into the paper until it was impossible to say where he ended, and the book began.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Three. The orb lit up, as though some ember smoldering inside it had finally caught fire. Asante didn't notice. She was amid her books with a headlamp, looking for instances of magic and other queer occurrences in Clackmannanshire, written and privately printed by a Scottish city councilman in 1841. She'd read it years ago, but something about Perry's case rang a bell, something that made her think that Perry should be transferred to a more secure facility. He needed constant watching. Maybe they all needed watching. But she had to know more to be sure. She still hadn't found the book when she heard the numbers clacking on the machine. She ran to her desk, picked up the phone, and hit a switch. Sal was in her new apartment, a tidy little unit in a nondescript apartment building in a nondescript part of Rome. Someone in the Vatican, she would never know who, had arranged it for her. It was ready for her when she got there. White walls, a double bed under a fluorescent lamp, a small wooden dresser, a little table with two chairs, a shaded balcony that looked out over the alley behind the building, where cars went into and out from the parking garage underneath. It would do. Her phone pinged. She didn't know she had an international plan. Someone must have arranged that, too. She got Asante's message and hurried across town, into the library, through the wooden door, down the stairs. "You're the last one here," Grace said to her. She was standing in almost exactly the same spot she had been before. Did she even move? Sal thought. Liam was on the couch, tapping away at a laptop. As soon as Grace was done talking, he raised his eyebrows and shook his head. "I heard that," Grace said. "Where are we going?" Sal said. "Madrid, it appears," Asante said. She was poring over a stack of papers at her desk.
"Though where exactly is unclear," Liam said. "We have the coordinates."
"Yeah," Liam said sarcastically.
"We have the coordinates."
Manchu nodded.
"Good."
He turned to Asante.
"Any idea what we might be facing?"
Asante didn't look up from her papers.
"Madrid has been officially purged of magic for over 500 years.
She gave a sad chuckle. "The Inquisition?" Sal asked.
"Oh, no,"
Asante said. The Inquisition was just a witch hunt and not of real witches. Nothing to do with magic at all. She turned a page. But even so, Madrid seems dry. There was a brief flurry of magical activity during the Spanish Civil War and the usual spotty records of underground societies during the Franco years and after. But they seem like dabblers. There's no indication that any of them got hold of anything truly magical. No books or artifacts or anything else that I'm aware of. So whatever we're dealing with, it's rogue, Grace said. That's right. Possibly predating the Inquisition when they declared the place clean. Urbic? Liam said. Could be, Asante said. But that's a guess, not even a hunch. So we don't know what we're facing, Grace said. At all. Afraid so, Asante said. This isn't going to be like Eia Flakia Jokic, is it? Grace said. Asante looked up at last, slightly irritated. No, this is not going to be like Eia Flakia Jokic, she said. The volcano in Iceland? Sal said to Liam. Yep, Liam said. You know those eruptions in 2010? No one could fly in Europe for days? Apparently not entirely the result of natural forces. Grace interrupted. There was a dragon, 7 stories high, living under the volcano, which had been there for over 1,000 years and was the subject of several local legends. But were we told any of this when we got on the plane? My Icelandic was rusty, Asante said. It won't happen again. It's certainly not going to happen in Madrid, she said with a sudden authority that made Sal believe her. Grace did too. She backed down. Well, whatever is happening in Madrid, Liam said. Haven't heard anyone call the police about it yet. Thank God, Menchu said. What happens if the police get involved? Sal said. You're a cop, Liam said. You should know. Things get a little messy. Let's just say the sooner we get there, the better. He sighed. Why can't they just take the books out to a barn up the back house of nowhere and open them up there? Everything would be so much easier. How's your Spanish? Grace said. I can order at a Mexican restaurant, Sal said. That's about it. Grace shook her head. Americans, she said under her breath. They headed out to the airport. 4. The family living downstairs from Gabriel heard noises above them and thought it must be the building. In the apartment upstairs where Elena and Victoria lived, the family heard their floorboards creaking when they weren't walking on them. Something was going on below their feet. Go down and see how Gabriel is doing, the parents told their daughters. They knew he lived alone, and even if they didn't know him well, they were worried about him. So the daughters skipped down the stairs to Gabriel's door. They knocked. There was no answer. They knocked again. They felt a rush of air around their ankles, first toward the door, then away from it, like a long, sighing breath. Then the door opened, all by itself, and great hands, strong yet soft, scooped them up and took them in. The girls didn't get a chance to see what the apartment really looked like now. For Elena and Victoria, Gabrielle's apartment disappeared. Their own selves disappeared. They became wizard queens, floating in the air and creating kingdoms all around themselves with waves of their wands. They sprouted transparent wings from their backs and became pirate fairies, raiding ships and islands that floated in the sky. They were swooping dragons in a world where the only land was a sheer and never-ending cliff that disappeared into the clouds above and below them, and cities like gigantic mushrooms grew from trees that clung to the rocks. At last, they were sea creatures they couldn't have described to themselves, even as they were described in the book. They were slim beings with fins and gills, long, flowing tentacles, braids in their hair. They swam in a pink ocean among 8-eyed leviathans and a web of towns that drifted in the current together like a school of jellyfish. They didn't know where they really were or what was really happening to them. It took the girls' parents a few hours to realize something was wrong. The sisters' visits with Gabrielle were never short, but the kids were always home before dinner. How long have they been down there? Their mother said. The father looked up from his phone. He hadn't realized how late it had gotten. I'll go get them, he said. He headed downstairs to the landing in front of Gabriel's door. He could hear what he thought were voices. He could hear something, anyway.
Elena, Victoria, he called.
They didn't answer. He put his hand to the door. It was warm, warmer than it should have been. There's a fire in there, he thought. He called out his daughter's names again. There was still no answer. He ran down the stairs to the superintendent, and they both came back up to Gabrielle's landing.
Gabrielle, the superintendent called. Are you in there? Are those girls with you?
The superintendent tried his key. It turned, but it didn't unlock the door. Then it stuck, as if held there, as if something had reached into the lock from the other side, something with very powerful fingers, and had latched hold of it. The superintendent jiggled the key.
I can't even get it out, he said. My girls are in there, the father said. Gabrielle, the superintendent yelled. If you don't open this door in 30 seconds, I'm calling the police.
They waited. It was quiet on the landing. Then they felt the air move all around them from up and down the stairs as if it were being drawn under the door to Gabrielle's apartment. They watched as the door flexed outward in its frame. It was inhaling. It was as obvious as it was impossible. They felt the wind rush around their ankles, first toward the door as it ballooned, then away, back into the stairwell as the door smoothed and flattened again. They looked at each other. Each one confirmed to himself that the other had seen it. Call the police, the father said.
You are listening to Book Burners, created and produced by Realm, your portal to another world. Listen away.
Anna Sheridan, New York Times bestselling author of supernatural horror. Missing for nearly 6 months now.
That's not possible. Is the compass broken? Or did I turn to the side?
Given the circumstances of her disappearance, someone with a more vivid imagination might decide she'd pierced the veil, so to speak.
Weak radio signal. 700 meters. Closing fast.
There's no place for ghost stories and close encounters in this investigation, or any other.
I need you to find me.
To save yourself.
Of course. What else would it be?
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
Book Burners is created by Max Gladstone and written by Max Gladstone, Margaret Dunlap, Amal El-Motar, Murr Lafferty, Andrea Phillips, and Brian Francis Slattery. Executive produced by Molly Barton and Julian Yap. Performed by Exe Sands. Audio production by Amanda Rose Smith and additional editing by Corey Barton and Brooks Ewald. Original theme by Hashem Asadolahi. Featuring Jody Redditch-Ferber and mixed by Justin Morell. Cover art by Annie Wu. Executive in charge for Realm, Mary Asadolahi. Find more shows like Book Burners by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm.